My involvement with Daniel ends when I go off on the run. I realized that I wanted to commit tax fraud and try to get enough money up to run down to Brazil. I got to Dallas, stole $67,000 in Dallas, bought a Jeep Cherokee. I went on the Route 66 trip, committed fraud upon fraud, got to Las Vegas, stole $160,000 out of ATMs there, Oceanside, California, another $150,000, Los Angeles for another $120,000, and back to Las Vegas, where I stole $160,000 that night. Woke up the next morning, signed on to cartersmarket.com. There is my name, U.S. Most Wanted, beside it. I sat there, I stared at it. Took me a minute to click on it. I didn't want to click on it. There was my picture. First time my picture had been shown on any criminal website at all. There was my picture, my real name, and a link to the United States Secret Service. So here I am, United States Most Wanted, Las Vegas, Nevada. What do? Idiot goes to Disney World. Went to Disney World, bought the year pass, rented a timeshare for 9 months, figured I'd lay low for a year, and then bug out to Brazil at that point. Lasted 6 weeks. Secret Service came and got me, arrested me, sent me to prison, and served out my time, finally. Yeah, that's idiot.
After the hacker gets away, after the FedEx Kinko's drop, what happens next?
Well, after that, there was kind of a little bit of a lull in the case. We were able to get surveillance video of him walking in, but he had a hood on and a jacket, so he concealed his face. He was very detailed about being anonymous. The most positive thing about the case is it wasn't a bust that night because we still had our CI communicating with him through encrypted email. We instructed our CI not to engage him, like, hey, did you get the money? Did you get it? Everything go okay? Just told him, don't mention anything about it. Just play it as if nothing.
Anytime you lose $68,000, you're a little disappointed. Fortunately, it did buy us a lot of street cred with him, and I think it built up a lot of rapport with him.
It solidified our position as a fellow bad guy because the hacker got his $68,000, no muss, no fuss. Now things seem to be running very smoothly.
He's continuing to file tax returns into our undercover bank account. It's growing and growing over time.
The undercover team then advised the hacker that we had a friend in the banking industry who could look the other way and handle very large sums of money. And then the hacker filed even more fraudulent returns with the IRS, directing that the refunds be now directed to our undercover account. The other thing that we were able to tell the hacker was that this account was so magical, if he had any funds that were stuck anywhere in the country, you could possibly transfer them, and then we could get his money to him that way. The hacker then sent the undercover agents a list of other accounts that the IRS did not know about.
He made claims for over $5 million, and then the amount received was over $1.9 million.
The IRS's Fraud Detection Center was monitoring all the IP addresses that were being used for the returns being put into our undercover account. From what I understand, he was what I guess you call spoofing or proxying the IP addresses. He was basically hiding them. But then we got a break. One of the IP addresses on one of the returns he did, he let slip through, and we were able to capture it, and we were able to determine it came back to a Verizon Air card.
In 2008, before the miracle of Wi-Fi, you could get what was called an air card that you could put into a computer, and then your computer could then connect to the internet.
An air card was like a mobile device that you'd put into your laptop. So it had a designated phone number through like Verizon or AT&T. And that's what you use to get on the internet and, you know, like what we see with our hotspots now.
You start to see a pattern that when the hacker sends the undercover team an email, the air card is operating at that exact time. We need to find this air card. That's our holy grail at this point.
I didn't think that they would just let me walk. I thought that if there was a sting operation at that Kinko's, you know, they would have like tried to grab me or like pulled guns out and told me to stop or something like that. So when I got home, I thought, no, it probably wasn't agents. I was probably just paranoid about it. There's no way I would have gotten away with that. But I was also concerned about how much exposure I was giving myself. I just felt like it would be safer if I got out of the city for a while. So I would go backpacking in Big Sur for like long periods of time. I would hike off trail to other areas that were more secluded. And Big Sur is basically just living out of a big 65-liter backpacking backpack. So I would have a tent and a sleeping bag, camping gear. There is a sense of loneliness when you just kind of dump your identity and assume some other identity. It kind of makes you think of where is this going and like what's the end goal. I was thinking, you know, maybe I should just stop all this and lay low and live out a simple, quiet life somewhere. I would just make enough money where I could move from the U.S. to some other country and not have to work and just live off of that money. And then I wouldn't have to basically participate in society to any significant degree. At that point, my overall mission was I'm just going to withdraw completely from the system.
We got subpoenas to get the access to that air card information, and it came back to a person in the name of Travis Rupard with a P.O. box somewhere up in the Bay Area. I was able to get the copy of the P.O. box application. I ran the driver's license on the ID, and it was not a legitimate number. One of the IRS agents I worked with, they were able to determine that Travis Rupard had filed an identity theft report, that his identity was stolen.
Verizon had historical records of the air card communicating with cell towers. And then an FBI agent did an analysis of the data of what cell towers the air card was communicating with. It came to Santa Clara, California.
You do know, guys, you do know that there was some element of this case that we weren't allowed to disclose through some technology, investigative technology, right? Was that?
Yeah.
All right, you know we can't discuss that. Through investigative means, we were able to determine that he lived in an apartment complex right by Santa Clara University. Coincidentally, this apartment complex is 3 blocks away from a Caltrain station. Now, we could not determine the exact unit he was in, so I went to the post office. I was able to get the names of the people that get mail at those locations. We got all the water billing information. You have to provide an identification, like your ID or your driver's license. For one of the units, the ID that was given to Santa Clara was a bad ID. I'm like, okay, now we're in business. He rented that unit under Stephen Travis Brauner. And the ID on the photo fit the same description of the person that came in and picked up the money. I interviewed the apartment manager. I said, how does that person pay his rent? He's like, he always pays with money orders. I said, have you ever met him? She's like, you know what? I have never ever seen that person ever. So I'm like, all right, now we got something going.
And then we obtained what was called an anytime no-knock warrant. One of our greatest concerns was if the investigators, you know, knocked on the door, he could press a button and all of his computers would be wiped. A significant amount of the evidence would be destroyed. We tell the hacker that now his next cut is approximately $352,000.
He provided us the same instructions on how to send the box to him. And then he told us, okay, go ahead and ship it.
We were anticipating the long game on this one. We set up 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, surveillance on his apartment. We also had an agent in between his apartment complex and the Caltrain station, and we had guys set up at the Kinko's 24/7. As far as he knows, that package has been shipped, delivered, and he thinks it's sitting in a cage at a FedEx Kinko's. It was 4 days, and he still hadn't shown up. 4 days. What does that tell you about his patience and resolve? I chose to work the graveyard shift at the Kinko's because I wanted to arrest this guy. On the fourth day, it was around 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Our subject walks out of the security gate for the apartment complex onto the main street. The FBI agent follows him. But when he walks out of the apartment complex with the security gate, it clanks behind him. Our subject sees the same guy he saw in the courtyard on the street with him. Now he's getting nervous.
They were involved in this cat and mouse game with this guy near the apartment complex. Fortuitously, a local marked unit police car just happens to be driving by. The FBI agent says, hey, we're following somebody. Would you help us take him into custody? They didn't know if he was the hacker. They didn't know if he was associated with the apartment. All they knew was this guy looks like the guy that ran the apartment, and he's taking sophisticated counter-surveillance moves as we're trying to follow him.
Hey, that's him, that's him, that's him!
I just took off on like really fast sprint. But as I'm running across the street, another Santa Clara Police Department car very ever so slightly taps like the side of my leg, and I trip and fall down. And at that point, it was pretty much over with. One of them jumped on top of me and was like, let me see your hands, let me see your hands. And he was banging my hands onto the concrete so hard, my hands were scraped up and gravel was like embedded in my fingers. The palms of my hands were in really bad shape.
He had no identification on him, none. But he did have a set of keys on him. So the FBI agent took those keys, went back to the apartment complex. All he did was put the keys in the door of the unit that we suspected he came out of, and they fit perfectly.
The computer experts and the search team then descend upon the apartment. There's the air card sitting on a table attached to a computer. This is the air card that we've been looking for. Unfortunately for the hacker, when he left the apartment, he didn't turn his computer off, and it was up and running. So when the IRS CI computer expert sat down at the computer and pressed return, she was in. When the $68,000 was sent to the original FedEx Kinko's, the agents copied down all the serial numbers for every single $100 bill. And approximately, I think, 48,000 of that 68,000 was sitting in a closet in the apartment. We also found a significant amount of gold coins and silver coins, numerous prepaid debit cards, numerous false identifications, all types of equipment to manufacture false identifications. The IRS computer expert, searching the computer for evidence in the case, found a storage unit under another false identity. At that storage unit, what we found was, right out of a Jason Bourne movie, he had, from the State Department, a facially valid U.S. passport with his photograph on it in the name of a deceased person. If we had missed the hacker at that apartment, if he had been spooked and he had gotten away from us, he could have gotten on a plane and disappeared, and we would have never captured him.
Once we arrest him, you know, we took him back to the local police department and attempted to interview him. I mean, at this point in time, we don't know who he is.
They asked him his name, and he refuses to cooperate at this point and says nothing except, "You can call me sir."
I said, "You're not going anywhere. You're not going to be able to leave, so you're going to go in as a John Doe." I could not for the life of me figure out why he just wouldn't give me his real name. I just asked him, "Why won't you give me your name?" And he goes, "What's in a name?" And I said, "What's in a name? Everything's in a name." I said, "My parents gave me this name. I'm proud of this name." And I, for some odd reason, I could tell he got a little upset about that.
I would not give them a name. I didn't give them any information at all. My hands were so injured from that arrest that the machine wouldn't register my prints. So I actually had to wait like a week for my hands to heal in order to finally take me to the U.S. Marshals and get me printed in their system to find out who I was.
Turns out he was involved in some Beanie Baby fraud years before. And so at that point in time, we were able to then identify him as Daniel David Rigbane. This guy's the hacker.
I'm like, this is the guy behind the curtain. I mean, we were chasing this guy for a year and a half. We got him.
How much money had you taken from the IRS at that point?
I think it was probably around $500,000 in gold and cash and everything. They claimed a lot more, only because they factored in tax returns where I never actually got the money. Money that had been locked up by banks, because a lot of times banks would suspect something is going on.
Here's what I think the federal investigators say. It's 1,900 tax returns filed online, yielding $4 million sent to 170 plus bank accounts.
Yeah, it's way exaggerated. The final number was around like $2 million or $2.2 million or something like that. I think that $4 million amount is what I attempted to take.
We issued him a 50-count indictment: mail fraud, wire fraud, access device fraud, tax fraud, fraud against the government, aggravated identity theft. With all these counts and charges and the loss amount, he was potentially looking at anywhere from 14 to 17 years in prison.
Marshals sent me to Florence, Arizona, at a private detention facility out there ran by Corrections Corporation of America.
One thing I remember you saying to me one time is that even as you're being arrested, you had the feeling that they cheated.
Well, I just knew that there was no way that they could have caught me. There's no way that they would have found my residence. Nobody knew that I lived there. They never followed me back to my house. That was what bothered me. There was a big question in my mind about what they had actually done. I knew they tracked the air card just because there was no other weak link, but I didn't know how. My court-appointed attorney gave me a copy of the search warrant affidavit that they used to get the search warrant to search my apartment physically. And there was a small paragraph in there about how they used some type of like cell site information to locate the air card. But cell site information isn't accurate enough to get down to a specific apartment. So they said cell site information and other investigative techniques. So the mystery was, what were those other investigative techniques? And that's what I wanted to figure out.
The very first thing that I did is I started writing down my theory of how they actually located the air card. I would work on this like document, and it was more than just writing down how it was done. I had written diagrams, and I drew pictures of like cell towers, cell phone networks. I started talking to another guy in there at CCA named John Wigglesworth. And he'd always says, well, this sounds like they needed some type of like electronic surveillance order, a wiretap or a trap and trace or a pen register. He said they needed something in order to do this type of thing. You can't just like go and do that. Like, I knew that the Fourth Amendment came into play.
The Fourth Amendment protects your right against unreasonable search and seizure. And it generally requires law enforcement to get a search warrant, which means they've gone to a judge, they've shown probable cause, and they've shown a particular place to be searched, and convinced the judge to issue the warrant. All of the old cases concerning the Fourth Amendment have always concerned property, search of your house or your person, the search of your pockets, the search of a jacket, the search of your car. Only in the last 10 years were the courts starting to weigh in on what does it mean that everybody has a computer in their pocket by means of a smartphone. And at the time when Rig Maiden was litigating this, there was very little case law and very little precedent on what the legal standards would be.
John Wigglesworth recommended that I go down to the law library and like do some research and figure it out on my own, because he said the attorneys aren't gonna do anything for you out here based on his experience. So I felt like it would be better if I represented myself.
I was a prosecutor for approximately 25 years. Generally, when someone represents themselves, it's going to be a huge pain in the rear.
As a defendant, when you decide to go pro se, the court gives you a very strict admonishment, like, this isn't generally good for you, it is your right, but, you know, you could use the help. It's generally stupid, just flat out stupid to go pro se.
He was a very zealous advocate on his behalf, and that's not uncommon for pro se defendants, but I think what makes him different is that he actually was able to get information revealed.
I suspect it's some type of high-tech cell phone tracking, but at that point it was just a theory and I couldn't go to the court with that. I needed actual documentation proving that they had done these things. So I started putting in like massive discovery requests to the government, asking them for documents on how they tracked the cell phone down and everything else. They ended up delivering file box after file box. A lot of it wasn't relevant to what I was trying to do, but what I did need was like buried in there somewhere. So I had to go through every single page.
Rick Maiden is in custody. He's in a pretrial detention facility which does not allow visitors. And he has nothing to do all day, every day, 7 days a week.
I would just go through it page by page and read whatever was on there, waiting to find something. And I eventually finally found a document that talked about the cell phone tracking.
What happened was in the notes that were turned over to Rick Maiden in the discovery, an agent mentioned the term stingray.
In that report, I mentioned a device called a stingray. I use that as a general term, like a good comparison, like when someone says, instead of saying tissue, they say Kleenex.
I see the word stingray, and it's at that point that I know that I found what I was looking for.
A postal inspector had screwed up, and in a single email sent to an FBI agent, used the term stingray once. That was the only signal that Rick Maiden had that a stingray had been used.
It's kind of funny because Rick Maiden, during all the criminal proceedings, referred to my report as the Wilson Report.
I basically just multiplied my discovery requests, focusing in on stingray technology. And I also started thinking about strategies to search the internet on this term and see what I could come up with.
Now, you're not connected to the internet.
No, I didn't even have a computer at that point.
There was this, like, carrier pigeon internet protocol that took place where his outside shadow counsel would do a Google search and give the printout to Rick Maiden. And then Rick Maiden would circle the things that he wanted to look at and hand it back to his shadow counsel, who would then print out the results of that and then take them back to Rick Maiden.
It had taken me years to actually get the data sheet, and in that data sheet had all the information that verified my original theories from years prior about how the government had located my air card. This is the document that I've been waiting for. This is what's gonna get me out of this place.
I've been pushing back and fighting against government surveillance for several years, and you get letters from people who think that they're being tracked. And many of them are just straight up crazy. Many of them are behind bars and are looking for like any ray of hope that will get them out. In 2011, I get this email. Two minutes in, I had an oh shit moment. And I knew that he had the goods.
Stingray was not like a well-known term. Definitely in the government, people knew what it was, but the general public was not largely aware of what a stingray was. A stingray is a device that law enforcement uses, and it mimics a cell tower. So it's a small portable cell tower, and it forces your cell phone to connect to that device instead of connecting to the cell towers ran by your service provider. So if you're on Verizon and your phone would normally connect to a Verizon cell tower so you get service, when the government uses Stingray in the vicinity of your phone is gonna connect to that government device instead of to your service provider's cell tower. And once your phone is connected to that government cell tower, they can do whatever they want. They can monitor your communications, or they can use radio waves to figure out exactly where you're located.
When police use a stingray, the device is also connecting to everybody's phone in the area, even if there's only one person there that they're interested in. In contrast, if you go to the cell provider, you're asking for information for, you know, Jennifer Granick's phone number. You're not getting everybody else's information.
This device, or devices like it, they can be handheld, they can be mounted in vehicles, they can even be mounted on the underside of airplanes and helicopters and drones. And so the police can sort of drive around a neighborhood and then walk through an apartment building, beaming their signals into each room in order to figure out where the target is.
It's a trademarked name by Harris Corporation for their specific type of cell site simulator.
the Harris Corporation is a large defense contractor. Harris has the contract for the next generation air traffic control system. They have the contract to manage the president's encrypted phone.
They have a surveillance division where they make nothing but cell phone tracking surveillance equipment. So that's their primary product when it comes to like domestic law enforcement, even military as well. We got a lot of info on how Harris went about making their devices and selling them, and different law enforcement agencies that had obtained them in Arizona, Florida.
I was floored. The prospect for widespread abuse of civil liberties was so apparent that I was drawn into this. I went to trusted colleagues at public interest groups. I went to legal scholars and I said, I think there's something here. And no one took him seriously. Eventually, I reached out to Jennifer Valentino DeVry, who was a reporter at the Wall Street Journal. She was on her way to DEF CON in Las Vegas, and I sent her this like 100 or 200 page brief, and I sent her a couple links to the docket. And then when she landed, she emailed me and she's like, I'm sold. This is it, I'm doing this.
It was a crazy read, honestly. It was good airplane reading. You don't usually see cases going on this long. You don't see this many motions, and you don't see a bunch of handwritten motions. You know, it was hundreds of them. This was the first time I'd seen handwritten motions that weren't actually somebody who was having mental health issues, right? These were handwritten motions that culminated in something that actually made sense. And that was really unusual.
I actually got a copy of the newspaper in jail, which is pretty interesting to get that article and while you're in there.
It was a front page story in the Wall Street Journal. And Jen's story, one, blew the lid off this thing, but it also legitimized it. Suddenly, this guy wasn't nuts. Suddenly, Brig Mayden was right.
This was 2011. It was before Snowden, and people were not maybe as used to the idea that the government was just getting everything on them. So I think it got a lot of people's attention.
Little is known about the device's capabilities because law enforcement agencies that buy one have to sign confidentiality agreements.
There's not that other person there who might object or say, hey, you need a higher court order in order to do this.
And we asked police departments across the valley if they had Stingray systems. Some haven't responded, others won't admit it on record, but privately tell us they have them.
No, we don't like to talk about it. You know, when a general goes in battle, he doesn't give out his battle plans.
They can follow everybody around all the time. They can say they won't do it, but there's nothing that says they can't.
It's the classic question, safety or privacy?
The folks at the ACLU were very interested in it.
The ACLU and Electronic Frontier Foundation wrote an amicus brief in support of Mr. Rig Mayden. But Daniel Rig Mayden accomplished what thousands of criminal defense attorneys before him had never achieved, which was to get the government to admit that it had actually used this device in its criminal investigation.
This technology was first used in the early 90s, the precursor to the Stingray. It shouldn't have taken 20 years to get public debate about this. It shouldn't have taken the coordinated efforts of a few activists and a guy rotting behind bars to expose this technology.
Everything was being done through a Verizon air card. It wasn't wired into any hardwired connection. So if the government ever got that IP address and they subpoenaed Verizon, all they would get is it's just a card being used at these cell towers in this area. I think it was like maybe 4 square miles or something like that. So the next step was they were gonna drive the Stingray around and get the precise location of the air card. They drove out and used the Stingray in that area. They can use their laptop to see which cell phones are connecting And by driving around, they take multiple location estimates and they average them all together, and it allows them to get a very precise location estimate of where the device is located. But they have to have every device in the area connect to it in order to find the device they're looking for. They have to go through all these different cell phones that don't belong to the target. They belong to innocent people that they're not even investigating. My entire defense was to file this specific motion to suppress the evidence they obtained using their Stingray device. Because if I could suppress the location of my apartment, then they have no case, because all of their evidence stemmed from the location of my apartment.
Rig Maiden's case was a real David and Goliath story. There's Daniel Rig Maiden in his orange jumpsuit and me on one side of the courtroom. And then on the other side, there is an army of people in suits.
They had flew people out from the Department of Justice in Washington and FBI headquarters in Virginia.
Rig Maiden was extremely focused, very, very sophisticated legal arguments and pleadings, as if he was a skilled lawyer who had graduated from law school and passed the bar. I said, Judge, if you allow him to file a 200 plus motion, this is setting a bad precedent. And the judge asked me in open court, he goes like, do you really think, Mr. Batista, you'll ever see anything like this again? And I mean, I had to be honest with him and say, no.
Rig Maiden was saying the government didn't obtain any court authorization. And then the government was saying, no, we obtained court authorization. Look at this particular order.
One of Rig Maiden's arguments is that the information we provided to the magistrate judge was insufficient to authorize the conduct that we undertook to locate the air cart. And that there was violations of other people's rights, because for a very brief time, the federal government does have a record of the location of all those other electronic devices that communicated with their cell site simulator.
It didn't seem to comply with the particularity requirement of the Fourth Amendment. Particularity means if the government seeks authority to conduct some type of search or seizure, they need to explain specifically what it is they're going to search and what it is that they're going to seize.
There is no doubt that our warrant did not lay out in detail how these devices would operate. But we had a very specific target. We were very particular about what we were looking for.
The hearing concluded and the judge said he would wait to rule on it. I knew that it was bigger than just me. I knew what the government was doing with their technology was something that everyone should be concerned about. Some weeks later, he issued his order. He denied the motion to suppress and said that the government, although they could have been more clear in their order, that he felt like that they hit on enough points in order for it to be authorized what they had done.
The judge issues his formal order. But he also says using the device to capture and figure out where Daniel was located was a search under the Fourth Amendment. No courts had ever said that this was a search. And, the government, they conceded that it was a search. And this was really groundbreaking. I was disappointed, obviously, that we couldn't get the good result for Daniel. But in terms of furthering the law for other defendants who are going to come after Daniel, I think what he got out of it is something that's beneficial to all those other defendants as well.
In they had, to some extent, lost an important aspect of the case in that they had to admit that they were using this technology that people really didn't know anything about.
This would set the standard for how the government would proceed from that point forward. Immediately after the motion was denied, I was offered a plea deal. I got a letter from the government saying that they would just give me time served and let me out. I could basically walk out like a week later or something like that, I think was their offer.
Why'd they do that?
I'm not sure. It was a very short letter.
The plea did keep him from appealing the case, whether that was the goal or not. I don't know, but it did have that effect. And it was better for the government that Daniel not appeal the case, because then they wouldn't get precedent that would be binding on a bunch of courts, including a published ruling that could go against them.
Because Mr. Rigmaiden was so suspicious of just the government in general, the plea negotiations took approximately 9 months. I had made a decision early on in the case to hold on to the gold and silver as evidence. The IRS originally wanted to sell the gold and silver when it was first seized. But I said, no, I would like to maintain this for evidence at trial. There are certain things that just have a great impact in the courtroom. Stacks of gold and silver coins, they would be one of them. By the time he ultimately agreed to resolve the case, the gold and silver had appreciated so much in value that, including the cash that we found, the bank accounts, and the gold and the silver, the federal government actually made money on the case.
He actually made money
because Rigmaiden was such a wise investor in gold and silver. The government covered all the money that had been paid out in fraudulent tax returns, and the government actually made a small profit on top of it. He was held for 5 years and 8 months in a pretrial detention facility with no visitors, very limited options in terms of recreation. He served pretty hard time.
If he would have went with the attorneys that were appointed to him, he would have gotten 17 to 20 years. But this dude says, screw that, I'll handle it. And he does. I'm like, holy shit, you're a bad man. I mean, I'm a little jealous, to be honest with you.
That was it. I got to walk out of there.
It's extremely secretive. They can't let this get out, so they covered it up. They don't want to talk about it.
The very first iPhone came out like right before I got arrested. So there were no smartphones when I went into jail. And when I got out of jail, there were just smartphones everywhere. It was such a bigger part of society than it was when I had gotten arrested. I remember thinking, like, what are people looking at? Why are people looking at their phones all day? Like, what's going on their phones that they're so interested? I had an idea of the bigger picture of the fight that I was doing. I knew that it was affecting people on a larger scale.
Digital is different. If you're going to have long-term surveillance with stingrays and cell phone location surveillance, there ought to be a strong warrant requirement unless there's a national security emergency. The government certainly has been very unwilling to really lay out what the policy is. And that is part of the problem.
One of the things we learned from Daniel's case is that invasive surveillance tools that we don't totally understand are being employed in secret without public oversight or the adversarial judicial review necessary in order to ensure that this is something that we want to do and that we're regulating it properly.
Customs and Border Protection flew this unmanned aircraft over protesters at the request of Homeland Security.
Government watchdogs fear the planes were used to track protesters and perhaps capture cell phone data.
Fueron 551 veces en tres años. Según ICE, ellos usaron este tipo de aparato para ubicar a sospechosos por todo el país. El intento de esta tecnología poderosa fue cazar terroristas, conectando en secreto a sus teléfonos celulares. Pero ahora se usa para localizar indocumentados acusados de crímenes.
That combination of secrecy and lack of oversight is pervasive in the surveillance world. It applies to location tracking technology, it applies to big data analysis of our phone calls or internet connections.
It used to be that you got a measure of protection simply because there were areas that technology couldn't reach. All of that has disappeared in the last 5 to 8 years. Now there is virtually nothing that technology can't reach.
People are really becoming aware that we don't fully know what our government's capabilities are. It's almost always true that it's in the context of some kind of criminal prosecution that's where we learn about new surveillance technologies or we establish civil liberties rights for people. These almost always take place in the context of a criminal prosecution where somebody's allegedly done something wrong. In the end, he ended up doing all of us a big favor by revealing the methodology or the scheme through which these kinds of surveillance technologies were being masked from the public and even from courts.
I've always thought about how there's problems with society and I don't want to participate because things aren't the way that they should be.
Being able to break the system or get around the system gave me a feeling of power in a society where everyone has their power stripped from them in some way.
So this is one of the rare occasions where I actually did have the power to change something, and I'm happy that I was able to.
At Rigmaiden's sentencing, he told the court that he had not been a member of society, and he'd been taking the government's money that could have been used to help other people. He wanted to come out of the shadows and join society.
Now that I'm out, I do continue to work on surveillance issues.
Daniel Rigmaiden, who now consults with defense attorneys on government surveillance, fears innocent people's information could be scooped up from their cell phone and saved.
There's a lot of people who say, if you don't have anything to hide, what do you have to worry about when it comes to surveillance? But eventually, your idea of things that should or should not be hidden is going to change. And maybe things that you think that you don't have to hide today, you'll have to hide tomorrow. Maybe they're going to come after you next.
Thank you. We'll be right back.